Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. We'll start today with our week in review and a trial date for accused Boston Marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev. Defense attorneys called the November start too soon, but some of the victims say they're eager for justice.
The way I was burnt and dismembered and mangled, you know, I think there should be a little bit of that also included in what his sentence should be.
Also this week, responding to a surge in violence in the city, Mayor Marty Walsh pushes for another gun buyback program, despite scant evidence that they work.
It's not going to be the typical gun buyback program that people talk about. We're looking at how do we create something that gets the guns that potentially are involved in these crimes on the streets off the street.
And the economy is booming in Boston, but certainly not for everyone. So what can City Hall do to remedy economic inequality?
For us, it's making sure that people who, you know, have less income understand that there are pathways, that there's ways for them to lift themselves out of that situation.
And yet another winter storm hits the city and the region.
The windshield wipers were kind of clogging up with snow. They weren't really helping, so I had to stop and try and clear them off.
It slowed traffic, closed schools, and prompted the question, have we become a state of weather wimps? Well, we'll dig in and dig out of all these stories with our Week in Review panel. This week, Shannon O'Brien joins us. She's a former state treasurer and candidate for governor. Hello, Shannon. Former candidate for governor, I should say. Hello, Shannon O'Brien.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, good to have you, and welcome to Radio Boston. And joining us from the Boston Globe, where he's the editorial page editor, Peter Canellos is here as well. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Anthony.
Good to have you. Well, this week, we'll jump right in to the Boston Marathon bombing case. A federal judge ruled that the trial of the accused marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev will begin on November 3rd. That's almost a year sooner than the defense team had asked for. Mark Fukaril lost his right leg, broke his back in the attack. He was outside the courthouse earlier this week.
I mean, I can wait as long as it takes. It doesn't matter. I mean, the outcome's going to be the same. He's going to die. He's either going to die in jail or he's going to die sooner. I just prefer to save our taxpayers some money and just get it done with and get it over with. The sooner the better. I mean, it's pretty much a cut and dry case. You see him in the photos with the backpack, without the backpack.
So perspective there from one of the survivors of the attack. Peter, first to you, the November trial date is considerably sooner than the defense was hoping for. Tsarnaev's lawyers have a huge amount of material to go through, 2,000 pieces of physical evidence, massive quantities of digital evidence. They argued that this was too soon. Do you think this gives them time to mount a credible, fair defense in this case?
Yes, I do. But I also think that, you know, this trial is important enough that, you know, the judge should be, you know, as generous as possible within reason to the defense so that there isn't any kind of a procedural error or argument about unfairness that might prolong the process after a verdict is obtained.
Yeah. And Shannon O'Brien, what are your thoughts on this? Does it look like Tsarnaev would be able to get a fair trial in this city with this kind of timeline?
I don't think it really matters what city this is in. This got such tremendous publicity all across the country, frankly, all around the world. And I do agree with Peter. I think that this has to be done right. It doesn't have to be done too quickly. And the defense is already complaining a little bit about not getting access to this voluminous amount of evidence that they're trying to review before they have to take this to trial.
Yeah. But the timeline, I mean, it's hard. Peter, you've got some legal training. I mean, I'm just curious, how much is reasonable? How much is unreasonable? We were talking about the number of terabytes of information that they have to go through. And it's just a huge amount. And they claim that, you know, less than a year isn't enough.
Well, as you said, I mean, less than a year from now, but as you said, it was a year and a half from the actual event. So, you know, I think just to a layman's sense of what is enough time, that may seem like enough time. But I mean, as you pointed out, there's a voluminous amount of material. Yeah. There's also not too much benefit in moving very, very quickly. I mean, I realize that there are people out there for whom a guilty verdict would mark closure. But I think in this case, people, as you're person outside of the courtroom said, you know, people have a strong sense that he did it, and they have a sense of the case being closed already. So getting it right is more important than getting it soon.
Yeah, Shannon?
I'd agree with Peter. And I think that just because they've set the trial date at this point in time doesn't mean that that's what happens. How all this rolls out, how the prosecution will give the evidence that they do have, how the defense team gets to review that, that in essence it could end up getting moved back anyway if it doesn't all roll out the way that I think the defense would like it to in terms of making sure that they are able to defend him properly.
And let me ask you both how you think this big, big trial, I mean, we've just had a big trial. The Bulger trial was certainly a big one. This, in many ways, I think is going to be even bigger. Do you think the city is ready to rehash these details of what happened, Shannon?
I think that the city has been rehashing these details quite a bit. I mean, this has certainly been in the news, and there's been such a great emphasis on this. You know, the One Boston Fund, you know, millions of dollars have been raised for the One Boston Fund. So I think that we've relived this time and again. So in terms of the city being ready for it, I certainly think that, you know, we've seen time and again the devastation that these two brothers have, you know, wrought or, you know, upon the city, upon the people during the marathon. And I certainly think the city is ready to bring this to trial.
Yeah, same question to you, Peter, before we move on.
Yeah, I pretty much agree. And, you know, unless there's some, you know, dramatic, unexpected revelation that somehow, you know, creates a divisive element in this case, I think that the city has been unified in its grief. It stood behind the victims, and it will do so again through the trial.
But the most important thing is going to be why. Mm-hmm. You know, finally actually hearing from this young man, why?
Mm-hmm. Will we hear that, though? I don't know.
I mean, yeah. That's what I think is interesting. I mean, my sense is you probably, you know, will not see him testify, but you could. Mm-hmm. You know, in reading some of the articles today, talking about, you know, when you have someone, you know, who is, you know, making a political statement, will he want to testify to make a political statement? Will that be hurtful? Will that be helpful? What does that do to the families afterwards? I mean, but the fact is, why is going to be, I think, the most compelling thing that people want to hear.
There's also been a suggestion, or there had been a suggestion earlier, that he may have been under the influence of his brother, or he may have been beaten, or there may have been something like that. If something like that came in that felt very exculpatory to some people, that could be the kind of divisive element that might make the trial a little bit more of a traumatic moment for Boston.
And we've already seen that with the cover of the Rolling Stone. I mean, they made him look handsome, and a lot of people went crazy about that magazine article and that picture. So it will be interesting to see how that rolls out.
Well, it will indeed be interesting. Let's move on. In the wake of a tragic shooting death of a 9-year-old boy by his 14-year-old brother in Mattapan last week, the Mayor Marty Walsh, is calling for a large-scale gun buyback program. And he said this about that this week.
There's not an easy solution here. You're talking about thousands of guns that have been confiscated in the last 3 or 4 years here in the city of Boston. We need to go out and do a better job of that. We need to educate folks.
Okay, so these programs, these buyback programs, they've been around for a long time. Boston has used them in the past. There is a lot of research that says they don't do much to get guns that matter off the street. Here's what David Kennedy said. He's with the John Jay School of Criminal Justice, and he was involved with criminal law enforcement in Boston back in the 90s. Here's what he said.
What you get are overwhelmingly older, often extremely old guns. A lot of them are not functional anymore, and there's some very clear academic analysis that shows when you look at the streams of guns that end up on the streets in the hands of people who hurt other people with them, those are not the guns that go to those places.
Peter, what's your view here? There was some good reporting in the Globe about this week. Is it worth bringing a buyback program back?
I think marginally it is. And I think that what it takes to you know, combat these kinds of crimes is a lot of coordination between the police, the city government, social service agencies, neighborhood groups, churches, people in the community. And these buyback operations can often be a way of building that kind of a grassroots network and contributing to that kind of a grassroots network. It's certainly not a panacea. I think you know, it's a bit of an easy call for politicians to just sort of inveigh against guns when it's much, much harder to build these kind of networks. But a gun buyback can be a way of putting together that kind of network.
I see. Shannon, what's your view on this response?
I probably side with Dave Bernstein, a Boston columnist, wrote, I think, a pretty great article. And although I don't know if I like the headline of it, it was, calling them moronic. I don't think I agree with that. I agree with Peter. And then I think that this can be almost a rallying effort effort that brings numerous groups together. But in terms of its efficacy, I don't think it works as well. David Bernstein made an important point that Boston has to do a better job of finding the people who are using and shooting the guns and prosecuting them and putting them in jail. That you know, I thought that was a very good point. I mean, again, I do think that the buyback brings a lot of community groups together, brings a lot of, you know, groups that need to be supporting and finding networks for people who are engaged in this gang violence and other types of problems. But I certainly think that this is a big problem, and Marty Walsh is trying to take a good first step.
Well, it's interesting, Shannon, because in terms of what David Bernstein said about finding the people and really focusing on them. David Kennedy from the John Jay Criminal School of Criminal Justice yesterday talked about Operation Ceasefire, which was so successful back in the 1990s here. Mm-hmm. And that was an effort by the cops to really identify the very few number of dangerous gang members and really bring the full weight of the law down on them. His sense is maybe that's not happening in Boston in the way it once was. I wonder if either of you, Peter or Shannon, have an idea if that's the case.
You know, I don't really know whether that's the case. I can tell you that, you know, I've seen that there are a number of different groups out there that are bringing resources into the neighborhood. You know, one of the jobs that I used to have in my sort of ridiculous, you know, vocational path is I ran the Girl Scouts in Boston. And I remembered coming into a meeting that Tom and Nina was going to be at, and it was near Orchard Grove School. And I remember I parked my car illegally because I'm late for this meeting with the mayor. And I came out and I could see all these policemen out there. And I'm like, are you kidding me? There's three cops that are going to ticket my car. And these and these guys actually were there outside of a school where young 8, 9, and 10-year-old girls were having this program. And they were out there watching gang members, just standing there watching them. And so I do think that there have been those efforts, but whether or not there needs to be some renewed spirit within the Boston Police Department, you know, I can't really speak to that.
Yeah. Peter, is that something you want to speak to?
I would certainly say my impression is that the Boston Police have continued to get more competent in these areas, so it's not a case of them abandoning something that was done in the 90s. I didn't read that column, but if they were suggesting that the specific policy of trying to put away a few leaders for a very long time and targeting those leaders, I can't say definitively whether that's going on right now. There has been a bit of a backlash against mandatory minimums. It could have been that that's what he was referring to. But, you know, I think that the solution is in building those networks that we were talking about in the community, and that's where the success will be.
Yeah, and by the way, speaking of building those networks, there was a little bit of news today in that Mayor Walsh announced an effort to better coordinate citywide violence prevention efforts, and this would be an effort to work across city departments, including police, public health commission, public schools, neighborhood groups. Peter, it seems like responding there to, or sort of picking up on a point there that you were making a moment ago about better coordination.
Certainly. I mean, I had toured the Yawkey Boys and Girls Club in Roxbury, and there are police in that club running a separate program that that works with the younger brothers and sisters of people who've been had interactions with the police, just to sort of maintain friendly relations between the families and police, and so that the kids don't get caught up in gang activity. It's that kind of thing that's going to solve this problem.
Sure. Well, let's move on to an issue, the issue of economic inequality in the city of Boston. Among big American cities, Boston has the widest income gap in the country. It's an issue that the new mayor, Marty Walsh, has pledged to address. And we spoke this week to his chief of staff, Daniel Arad Coe, and here's how he framed at least part of the challenge.
We're focusing too much on making sure that the Fortune 500 companies come to Boston. That will result in larger economic activity, may result in more people in Boston, which results in a shortage of housing, which results in higher prices, which results in more, you know, in inequality longer term.
So Coe talked about a bunch of measures, including targeting areas of the city like Dudley Square and Roxbury for development. The mayor has talked about this issue. Yesterday, Coe talked to us about the importance of making sure that people who have less income understand that there are pathways to help themselves out of that situation. But Peter, what's your view on this? I mean, obviously, this is a huge issue that is being talked about from the president to the governor to big city mayors all across the country. How much power does City Hall really have to influence this issue of income disparity?
Well, I think City Hall has a lot of power, and the spreading development throughout the city, encouraging the production of more affordable housing, but also really focusing on the schools so that there's a very clear path out of poverty for kids. Those are all things the city can and should be doing more of. I have a lot of respect for Coe, but I didn't hear that interview, but that snippet that you have with him saying that the solution to inequality is to bring fewer rich people in and get rid of Fortune 500 companies.
No, in fairness,
so the statistics go down. Well,
in fairness,
ridiculous.
In fairness, that was just a snippet, and he did speak a little more. You know, he put that in a broader context.
Well, if you were running for office, that would be a really bad soundbite. I don't think that's a solution at all. I really don't.
Shannon, your view on sort of what City Hall can do to address economic disparity?
Well, again, it is a double-edged sword when they have been successful in attracting industry into Boston and attracting people back into the city. It does create that dynamic. But you talked earlier around the reduction of crime. Coordinating these different groups is really one of the keys, and I think that's one of the nice things about having a new administration is bringing in fresh blood, bringing in a different perspective, and bringing in new synapses within the city. Again, harking back to my time running the Girl Scouts, it was fascinating to me to see just how many not-for-profits there are in this city that are focused on kids and youth development and improving self-esteem, shaking things up and figuring out new pathways to get people to work together, to leverage the existing resources that are here. I think that's really important. And also, the president just called in colleges and university presidents around the nation to get them to work on helping with this disparity, this income disparity. Mm-hmm. We have the benefit in Boston of having a lot of universities and colleges. And if Marty Walsh can leverage that along with what the president is doing and what the governor is doing, I think that could be very helpful.
Well, that would be indeed some powerful intellectual capital to bring toward this problem. Well, I want to talk a little bit about the weather. Another storm hit the region this week, and this is what I want to talk about. I mean, no one actually keeps great records on this, but it seems, Peter, your paper reported on this really interestingly today. Beth Tytel reported on this, that it seems like the bar for closing schools has fallen. So I want to play a snippet here. This is WBZ reporter Daniel Niles reporting from the shuttered campus of UMass Lowell yesterday at noon.
I just went out for a drive about an hour ago, and the roads are a mess, completely snow-covered. The highways may be a different story, but the secondary roads definitely slippery and slick with snow covering the entire area. And also here, obviously, on the sidewalks as well, we have about an inch and a half of snow that's on the ground.
Okay, now wait a minute. An inch and a half of snow, and we're talking about Snowmageddon? What's going on? Peter, your thoughts on this?
I happen to agree that we do have much earlier cancellations. I mean, quite often, just based on forecasts now, you hear about places being canceled the day before. I think that some of that is we have a much higher quality way of forecasting these storms, and so people have become much, much more comfortable making that decision just based on a forecast rather than by the storm, while there is still a significant element of chance in whether the rain-snow line includes Boston or not. So I do think that we've been canceling school a little bit more readily, and there have been some instances where you sort of are looking around thinking, really, we needed to cancel school today?
Yeah, it's true. Beth, I love what your reporter Beth Tytel wrote today. As the decades have passed, American society has become increasingly safety-obsessed, weather-crazed, social media-driven, traffic jam-phobic, risk-averse, and litigious. Shannon,
mad? Yeah. I loved waking up in the morning to listen to that fire horn in my hometown of East Hampton go off. What is it? 555-333. That was awesome. Now,
what did that mean? What did that
mean? It meant no schools, all schools.
Interesting.
How old are you? I can't be that much older than you.
I didn't hear the fire horn. I didn't grow up in East Hampton.
As a matter of fact, my new hometown of Whitman, they just had an article in the South Sunday paper about my hometown of Whitman keeping the horns, much to the dismay of many people living nearby. That was awesome. But you know what? Now, we didn't have daycare. Whoever heard of daycare when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s in Western Mass? And right now, I think that a lot of family, whether it's litigious or not, if you have daycare, if you have, both parents are working a job, making that decision the night before certainly makes it a little bit easier for families who have to scramble for childcare or other things like that.
And by the way, I don't think I am younger than you, because I remember growing up in Massachusetts walking to school during those blizzards and seeing cars buried and sort of being excited by
excuse
that.
Me, but did you hear that Al Roker actually took time out of his fabulous Sochi musings to kick the living crap out of Mayor de Blasio for sending kids to school in New York? And if you saw some of the photos coming in from New York City, you kind of wondered why he did send those kids to school. And he said it was daycare that he needed to make sure that those kids were taken care of during the day.
All right, folks, we're running out of time. I want to at least get to at least two hubbubs today, those stories that sort of fell below the fold. Shannon, let me come to you with your hubbub.
Well, today being Valentine's Day, and I am wearing my heart necklace that my husband gave to me many years ago, there's a sort of shocking story coming out of the New England Aquarium, in that the new renovations, the new coral reef that they have in there has now become a hotbed of love and illicit activity among all of the fish. So much so that the head diver actually referred to what's going on at the aquarium as likening it to a brothel. So I was a little bit shocked, but I guess on Valentine's Day it's an appropriate story.
It's a good one. Peter, how about you?
I'm looking ahead to the next holiday, St. Patrick's Day, and you never know what's going to, you know, which politician is going to be skewered the most at the Southie breakfast, but we might know this year, and it should be the City Council President, Bill Linehan, who had been the host last year and then was upset that he wasn't going to be the host anymore because Linda Dorsina-Forey became the state senator and took over that role. And so he's going to Ireland for St. Patrick's Day. It's a show of bad sportsmanship, but the best revenge will be available right there at the breakfast on St. Patrick's Day.
All right. Well, here's my hubbub. It's a baseball hubbub. The Yankee pitcher from Japan, Masahiro Tanaka, arrived in New York to be presented by the New York Yankees. Get this. He chartered a Boeing 787 Dreamliner. There were five of them, including his poodle, on a plane that can carry about 300 people. Five of them. It cost him $200,000 to do that. And as one aviation expert quoted in the Times said, totally over the top, so Yankees. So there's my hubbub.
And de Blasio will be hitting him with his own carbon tax when he gets done with it.
Shannon O'Brien, former state treasurer. She served in the State House and the State Senate from 1987 to 1995. She was a candidate for governor. She joined us today. Shannon, thank you. Come back. This was great.
Thank you.
We loved having you. And Peter Canellos, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Anthony. Thanks, Shannon. That was great.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, we'll hear from the new young chief of staff for Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.